Welcome to Season 2 of Beyond the Wall, a Game of Thrones LCG podcast brought to you by Istral and Darknotch. We'd like to thank FFG and CardGameDB for their continued support, and the fantastic AGOT community as a whole for being the sole reason we do this cast. Thank you for letting us take you once again beyond the wall.
Welcome to another episode of Beyond the Wall. Today we'll have a quick intro, then we'll have some FFG news with a briefing on what L5R is by Drakey and Alex. After which we're going to have a series of little short 2.0 segments on a variety of topics from melee rules and the ladies of Westeros. Rawr. And then finally some closing comments.
All right, John, this is episode 32, and you have just told me just before we started recording that you are not going to be a very useful co-host today.
That's absolutely true. I am totally wiped from working all day on the weekend.
Well, that's our lot in life.
Yep, that's the truth.
So we do have some news to go over this week. The first is we already have, we're recording a little bit early, but we just got the results for the UK Nationals.
I heard the top four had two Greyjoy and two Stark. Is that right?
No, there was a Barra, a Greyjoy.
AAA, a Greyjoy, no agenda, and a Stark AAA?
There may have been a Stark AAA as well, yes. But I do know what won the final was the Barra, the Maester's Path, played by Dave Bamford, who is actually one of the hosts of Banter Behind the Throne. And he beat his co-host in the top four.
So he went and took a DC deck to his national?
I don't know what the list actually looked like in detail.
How unoriginal. Right, Alex?
I haven't looked at the list. Actually, I would spin this a slightly different way. I would spin this in the fact that, first of all, remember when we started our podcast? We had a really good year. You won nationals, I won worlds. That was a great year. Yep. Maybe starting podcasts is the way to win this kind of thing. Second, there are now two English language podcasts with champs, national champs and so on, and one English language podcast with nothing but chumps. Which one might that be?
That'd be the White Book. I mean,
two champs, one chump?
Well, they keep changing the name. I mean, they're trying to hide from the fact that there's no champs. But you do what you gotta do.
Anyway, well, congratulations to Dave Bamford and to Banter Behind the Throne on that win. I think they had a fairly good attendance. I think that this also includes...
There was like 36 of them or something, right?
Yeah, it was over 30. And it includes lodging at Worlds. So I don't know if that means Dave can make it. I don't know how that's going to play out. I hope he can and represent his country for that. I'm sure we'll hear about it on his podcast next week. Mm-hmm. What else do we have for news? There's really not much Thrones news. This last week was nothing. But Star Wars news, my God.
Lots of Star Wars news and a little bit of Legend of the Five Rings.
That's right. There is that Legends of the Five Rings announcement. And
we'll talk about – well, you'll talk about that more on the cast. So.
Yeah, exactly. Basically, for those of you who don't know, Legends of the Five Rings, it was initially an AEG intellectual property. Wizards of the Coast held it for a couple of years. AEG bought it back, and now they've sold it to FFG. So FFG now has the rights to make – And they're going to make an LCG. They're going to probably continue the RPG lines, but presumably they have the rights to everything in that IP. I don't know much about L5R, so we're going to cut right now into a little bit of explanation with. Actually, will we cut right now? Do we have more news?
No, let's go right to Drakey.
Tell us all about it. So we'll start off. As I just mentioned, I know very little about Legends of the Five Rings. The only thing that I know about it, actually, aside from the fact that it's a CCG, is I was sitting next to someone who's very involved in crafting the story on a plane to Gen Con, and he was telling me that that was the main selling point of the game, that as players won tournaments and things like that, it affected the game to the point where even one of the factions has been eliminated. But I don't know much else, so I've brought on someone who's actually played the game, who knows a little bit about it, Drakey, all the way from Finland. So what, is L5R a big deal?
Well, L5R is interesting, I'd say. I think it's one of the bigger CCGs. Well, nothing compares to Magic, but still not the bigger ones. And it's old, from 95, I think. So it has a long history, and a lot of people have been playing it over the years. So many card players in other games have a background in L5R.
And so this has been a CCG with typical rotation, sort of like Magic. Recent blocks are used, chase rares, where you open boosters of random cards, that kind of thing?
Yeah, all of that. They have tried out some different kinds of expansions at times, like going directly to set boxes that are bought directly, but mostly it's been just the kind of all the CCG bad stuff, basically.
All right. Well, I mean, mechanically, it must have something that sets it apart for it to have lasted that long. I mean, not many games have. How would you compare it to Thrones? What would you, for our listeners that know Thrones, hopefully?
Well, I initially got interested in L5R a bit later than I got interested in Thrones, mainly because it was the second game being sold as one of the most complex card games there is. Which is really the kind of reason I got into Thrones initially as well. So, but there's some interesting stuff there. I think one big thing there is, on a mechanical side, it's interesting in that it has two decks, not like Thrones has a big deck and a separate small deck of plots, but two evenly sized 40-card decks, which is a pretty sort of interesting differential to other card games.
Oh, okay. So how are the decks differentiated?
The first one, called the Dynasty deck, contains both your characters and your locations. The characters are called personalities, and the locations are called holdings. But this one you don't draw your hand from. Rather, you draw four cards in front of you, and you play those. You can only play four locations or four personalities or combined during your round, and even less in particular scenarios. And the second one is the Fate deck, which contains your hand cards, basically attachments, which they have four different types of, and strategies, which are equivalent to events in Agate.
Yeah,
it's really different. I think there's lots of interesting things that might sort of happen here. Like there's some rules side. There's like things like there's specific existing actions that any player can do, like four or five, six of them you can do during your turn, which are not printed anywhere. You basically sort of need to know that they exist. And it's honestly, it's quite complicated as a game, and not only in the good way. A lot of it is just clutter.
I mean, as we've seen in 2.0, we could probably expect a fair bit of that to be cleaned up.
I think one of the sort of key questions is whether they keep all the four victory conditions, because that's already a really big deal. Because basically, there's first one is honor, which is like power gain in Agot, usually done by rush decks. Basically, you start with some honor, or like 6 or 7, and then you try to rise to 40. But then there's dishonor, which is trying to get your opponent to minus 20. And it's a control thing, because characters have limits of when they can be played, depending on your own honor. So it's going to have functions like choke also on the side. And then there's a military, which is just trying to destroy your opponent's provinces, which are the four cards in front of you where you can, the slots, four slots for cards in front of you where you can play cards onto the table. Mm-hmm. And each time you can attack those provinces, and each time one is destroyed, you can play one less location or one less character each turn, from the four down to three, then two, and once all are gone, you lose the game.
Mm-hmm.
And then the last one is Enlightenment, which is really, really weird. You have 5 ring cards, which you can all be run only one per deck. And then each have very specific sort of rules by which they can enter play. So if you win a military battle and then you destroy at least one opponent in this military battle, then you can put the Ring of Earth into play from your hand. And once you have all 5 rings in play, you win the game. It's like the sort of combo victory condition, because you have a lot of tutoring to find them from your deck into your hand, and then try to do the exact things in play to get them into play.
But those don't necessarily need to be built into the game. Those can be added later. Right?
Yeah, the
because
rings,
they don't have any fundamental rules specific to them, and it's a win condition. Like it could be once you have 5, it could be written on the card. Once you have 5 rings in play, you win the game, and
yeah.
It doesn't have to be built. It's not like the honor mechanic, which has to be tracked independently of cards.
Yeah, that's true. I think one of the things I'm really sort of looking forward to seeing is whether they keep Dishonored, because that's sort of, it would be fun to see, because I always sort of liked the idea of going into negative power in Aegot, screwing your opponent that way. It's a very control type thing, if you think about it.
It is kind of interesting.
It's interesting. It's quite curious.
Should I be designing my champ card to put, you know, shame tokens on an opponent's house card?
I mean, that's very good practice for L5R. So,
as I understand it, this game is... I mean, the first thing that anyone told me about it, the only thing I know aside from a little bit about the setting being sort of feudal Japanese-inspired, I'm not wrong with that?
Yeah, it's pretty much based on feudal Japan with all the samurais, ninjas, and courtiers, and there's some magical priests called Shugenja and stuff like that. And I think a big point of the game is that it's related very deeply to the RPG world in Rakugan, what the world's called, and they sort of coexist quite a bit between CCG and the RPG.
And those are both run by AEG, and those are both presumably migrating over to FFG,
yeah,
which has experience with both RPGs and the card games.
Yes. FFG bought the whole IP, everything in it, basically.
I mean, it seems like it's a weird thing for a company to sell. It was a large defining feature of AEG. I mean, obviously, they probably have financial reasons to do this. But how much do you think seeing the Thrones reboot motivated this? To be able to see how FFG was able to adapt an existing older game into a new system and pitch that?
I think quite a bit. I think Thrones, for one, and Netrunner just as much, basically.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Netrunner's actually probably a better case study.
Yeah.
You're right, yeah. There's one catch, and this is one that I'm sure that John will appreciate. FFG is not really known for their organized play, and AEG, at least in the L5R world, where they were strongly supporting these story-driven events where the winners would affect the story for the RPG, where the RPG stuff could affect the story for the game. And as I mentioned earlier, it's my understanding that some factions have even been completely phased out or fallen apart or been merged into other factions because of decisions from champions and results of clan wars and tournaments.
Yes.
So Can FFG keep that up? Do they, given their history with organized play, which is, you know, clearly still one of their very developing departments, can they manage that?
Yeah, that's a really good question, I think, because there's two sides to the whole interactivity thing. One is being able to choose things and how the world progresses. The other is writing, because L5R has a lot of story written based on the decisions coming out from the tourneys and from the RPG side. And FFG will need to both sort of get the interactivity into the tourney structure somehow and get the writing team on top of the normal LCG team they have, because you don't really need a writing team for any LCG currently, do you?
They have writing credits for Lord of the Rings for designing their scenarios and for shaping the story to those. So they'll have an insert with the chapter pack, or adventure pack as they call them, describing the new hero if they've invented it, or, you know, setting the tone for the scenario. So they do have writing credits there.
Yeah, and they do have the RPG team in-house, so they should be able to leverage that.
So maybe tell me a little bit more about the interactivity. I mentioned clans disappearing and things like that. Is that really just the world champion gets to say, okay, I'd like to nudge the story in this direction, or is this a communal effort? How does that work?
I think initially it has been so that there's the big tourneys like Gen Con and so forth. There's some kind of decision being made based on who wins it, and the winner also gets to affect how that thing happens. I think at one point they were vying for which clan gets to get one of their characters to be the new emperor or empress, as it turned out in that case.
Okay, and so does that inspire more clan loyalty? Are people more likely to play their clan because they want to advance the story or for things to go well for their clan?
Yeah, I mean, clan allegiance is a big thing in L5R. It's not just... Consider the Martel versus anti-Martel camps in Aegot. Take that to a different level and add all the factions in there. And that's what you get. Basically, each clan has their own forums, their own sites where they discuss strategy between the clan, in the clan, basically. I mean, there are sort of hardcore card players who play several factions, but sort of showing color is something that's been very much a part of L5R.
And so I wonder, I think, and I again, this was well before my time, this was in the CCG days, FFG did experiment with this sort of player-driven feedback in Game of Thrones. There was a plot, Minstrel's Muse, basically, that I think the faction that it wound up with, or it and another card, was sort of decided by this regional event where people were reporting tourney results.
I think if I remember this correctly, it was not a regional event. It was just the initial organized play tourney kits, basically. And they had sort of a questionnaire sheet where there was a few choices people could vote on. One was that who gets Minstrel's Muse, and another question there was which legendary character is reprinted. And I think that led to Balerion.
Was it only the winner of the organized play kit that was allowed to answer the questions, or was it weighted based on the size of the event? Do you know any of that in Thrones?
I don't remember, because I think each meta got to decide somehow between themselves, because it wasn't really sort of in that way followed. I think it just offered the metas who were holding the tournaments, holding the leagues.
Now, I'd sort of like to make sure that I bring this back towards Thrones. My impression from seeing this announcement of a game coming out in 2 years of the AEG losing this IP and saying, okay, selling off this IP and saying we're closing off with the last cycle, I see that as kind of a good thing for Thrones. I see that as a base of players looking for a complex game that will have this transition period where they'll probably have a look at FFG. And they may well stumble into Thrones as something with a sort of more swords and sorcery kind of IP rather than something like Netrunner or something like that. Unless they all go over to Doomtown run by the same company they're familiar with.
Well, I actually think we already have several L5R was losing a lot of players near the end, and I think we've already seen quite a few of those trying out Thrones 2.0 or being active on that side. And there's very many sort of similarities there. Most of the card types are very similar between the games. Even the sort of their strongholds kind of resemble a combination of a house card and an agenda in a way, and things like that. Yeah, I definitely see it as a sort of good opportunity for Game of Thrones. And there's actually some interesting sort of connections between Game of Thrones and L5R. The thing is, from the rumors I've been reading, it appears that AEG was sort of not selling, but it's rather that FFG contacted them on them wanting to buy L5R. And there's a really sort of curious reason for this connection here. The senior vice president of marketing at FFG, Steve Haworth, was behind the purchase quite a bit, as far as I understand. And Steve was previously the brand manager for L5R in the 90s, when the coast still owned L5R. And sort of he also negotiated the original selling of the L5R back to AEG from Wizards of the Coast. So basically he's just buying it back to himself now, in a way.
Now that and is he's interesting.
It's really interesting. And he's also sort of not just sort of casually interested in L5R. He's also been a top four player in one of the big, very big events called Second Day of Thunder on that side. So he's really a player as well.
Oh, okay. Now, there's another subject which I guess is drifting a little bit away from Thrones, but there's obviously a saturation point for FFG LCGs. Does this 2017 date herald something bad for Call of Cthulhu?
It could or it could not. I'm not sure. I mean, I think the saturation point for LCGs definitely, but what that concretely is, we really don't know. And like you said, this is tapping into a whole new player base. So how FFG will sort of, it's not only how it will affect it, but also how FFG will assume it will affect the game. Mm-hmm. So if they're assuming that the player base is just largely new from the L5R side, it shouldn't. But if they're assuming it'll be more cross-pollination from other LCGs, then it might.
Well, I can't say that I am really keeping an eye on L5R in the future, because I really have my eye right now on Thrones, but I certainly was surprised to hear this, and I'm glad we were able to chat about it. All right, well, that was Drakey telling us all about it. Did you have other intro news, or did we cut back to this for no particular reason?
No particular reason.
Ah, well, we're awful.
Yep, we are. We admit it, though.
So, John, today we're doing something a little bit different. I've got four, it might even be five, little short segments related to 2.0 that I sort of wanted to go rapid fire through, try a little faster format. And the very, very first one is some questions that I've seen pop up on the boards that are quite generic about the game and the product, about people asking whether they should buy in. And we've already covered...
Well, the answer to that is yes. You should buy in.
The first one we've sort of already covered, and it's something that's come up, and we've covered it on the cast, but maybe a very, very brief answer. How many core sets should you buy?
One, if you're having fun, and three, if you want to be competitive.
So that, my answer is buy one. If you like it, you'll probably be buying a second. And then depending on how late into the card pool's life, you may not need that third once you have enough cards to fill up the card slot. So I would say buy one, and if you enjoy it, buy a second one.
Tournament player right now, you'll probably buy three.
Right. Yes. Yeah, that's true. So another one that I thought was actually kind of interesting is the question, is the game appropriate for children? Now, this was not a complexity question. Obviously, you can judge that as a parent better than others. This was more of a content question, artwork question, things like that.
I'm going to say yes. I mean, if your kids are 9+, it's probably appropriate. Before that, I think complexity and artwork might be inappropriate in some cases. But in general, if you're maybe even 8+, you're good. And we've had some great players, actually, in Thrones that are of that age category of 8, 7-ish. So
We have in tournaments, and we've played against them. That is definitely worth noting. I might have some reservations there. So, for instance, in the 2.0 core set, we have the art piece that I think comes up more often, Heads on Spikes, in which you can,
it's kind of cartoony art in that one, too, though.
To some extent, yes. And I think it's about as high as the game gets for depicting gore in that way. So I think if you look up the card Heads on Spikes and you think that's too much, that is the upper end. I don't think there's anything beyond that.
The other thing is, when you look up something like that online and you see the detail that's on the card, it's not the same as looking in person where it's, smaller, far away. Most of the time, your kids don't even notice.
Most of the time. Well, speaking from experience, I know your kids have played around with your first edition cards.
They have.
And by played around, I mean made all sorts of strange stacks and destroyed cards, and you printed proxies just so they can destroy them.
Well, it's great that my kids are interested in the same thing I am.
That's right. And then the thematics of, frequent death of characters and the different roads. I don't think that's a problem.
No.
That
doesn't even come up when you're teaching rules, really. Exactly. You just tell them they can only have one of, and they're like, oh, okay.
I don't think that – the fact that the game is somewhat brutal or can be if you're playing very aggressively, I think that can be definitely the case for any of these other games. So I think
it's just a joke the kids don't understand kind of thing, yeah.
All right, another question that has come up quite a few times for people looking to buy into the game is the question, does the game contain spoilers?
There's quotes, so yeah, it definitely does.
So what would be your advice for someone who's hesitant about spoiling the TV show or the books or that?
I mean, like realistically, these small quotes and a couple key characters that you might have not, encountered in the book yet won't spoil the book for you. I don't think, at least. You'd have to be pretty anal to think that these small components would come together to form a story that would ruin the book for you.
Well, I mean, my first advice would be read the book because you've got time while you're waiting for the core.
And it's amazing.
But there certainly are things that once you've read the book and then you look at the cards, you're like, oh, well, this card's ability definitely reflects some major event from the book.
Tons of sense, yeah.
There are some things that are depicted on the cards in the artwork that are spoilers, but I will say that the vast majority of it in the core set is from the early books. I mean, almost all of it is from the first book, with the exception of some of the Greyjoy and Martell stuff. Primarily.
Even then, if you looked at the core set, you'd have a hard time piecing together the first book.
Yeah, I agree. It's hard to do it without any context. If you'd maybe made it halfway through the first book, you might notice something about the cards and be like, hold on a second. Why does Joffrey have this ability?
That guy's going to survive, or that guy's going to die. Maybe.
But I will say that it's highly constrained to the first book. So if you've seen the first season of the TV show, or if you've seen the first book, I feel like it's fairly spoiler light. If you haven't, I feel like you won't get the spoilers.
Yeah, I agree. It's like you said, you'd have to get halfway through to start appreciate them. At that point, you're already hooked to the book or the show, so you're good.
I think that may change as we get to things that depict the fifth book or the sixth book, hopefully, you know, in 6 years when it comes out. Where there may be some issues where you're already familiar with the characters and the lore, and the cards might depict something that you're like, wait, that hasn't happened yet.
So, like, the card game might get so far ahead of the book that the books don't pay attention anymore, or they're following the show since the show will be ahead of the book.
I don't think they're allowed to do that because of the way the IP works, but I wouldn't be surprised if even if they decide to do one cycle per book or something like that, like they were sort of suggesting the first cycle would match the first book. Yeah, they may beat Winds of Winter to the punch.
And it's kind of funny that you know, they might have to reach back and go for Duncan and Egg or something.
I don't even know if they have a license to do that either.
Oh, they can't go back in the books?
I know that there are some issues with characters that don't appear in the series, like Rhaegar Targaryen and things like that, that they've had issues with in first edition, and they said they weren't doing any more legacy characters like the Laughing Storm and so mm-hmm. on. So it may be that they just can't go a step back. Do you have any other questions like that that have sort of popped up?
Here's the problem. The people that I've been playing with recently have been all people that played 1.0. So these issues that, you know, new players have haven't been occurring.
All right. So for a second topic here that I wanted to throw in, this was actually inspired by the fact that we got to see Rob St. John stream a Melee game at viewer requests just a couple days ago on his YouTube channel.
Which was awesome.
It was awesome. I enjoyed it a great deal. I am surprised at the outcome of that match. I thought it was... So the thing I wanted to do... I mean, we've done segments in the past about how to play Melee a little bit in first edition. And I, you know, we haven't played enough Melee yet in second edition to do that kind of segment yet. I also feel like that would be too long for this sort of lightning segment thing that I want to do. What I wanted to do is to talk about some of the key aspects of building a deck for Melee. The way you change your valuation of certain cards. What kind of things do you value more in Melee than you would in Joust, or less in Melee than you would in Joust?
Yeah, so for me, big thing for Melee is cancel is way devalued. Because canceling one person's plan doesn't help you win the game. You have to be able to either cancel everyone's plan or just win yourself. So a lot of times, all those cards that would be focused on cancel, like Hand's Judgment, etc., I just ditch because I want to win. So
I think that's just a reflection of a sort of greater thing, which is in Joust, a card that trades you one for one, a thing like Put to the Sword or Put to the Torch, is quite good because it's hindering your only opponent. But if you're spending a card to hinder only one of your three opponents, that's not as good.
Ooh, I don't know if I agree with you there, Alex, because something like Puts the Sword, which actually removes a key character from the game, can remove a substantial amount of power if that character has renown. And on top of that, I find that Melee is actually about having two or three characters that are extremely important to your overall strategy and keeping them alive. So being able to kill one of those characters has a bigger effect than most people think.
I think that it's still less valuable in Melee than it was in Joust. I think
Sure, it's reduced. I agree with you in that way. But I think it's better than a lot of people give it credit for. So something like Put to the Torch, I totally agree with you. I think, you know, choking out a single opponent or destroying key locations from a single opponent doesn't have the effect you want. But I think that killing a key character can actually swing games.
But see, the main way that I would do that, and this is an aspect that I think is a changed valuation, is that you greatly value cards that can interact with other people's challenges. And so the key card that would come out to me for that would be something like Dracarys.
Yes.
The character does not need to be attacking you. It could be attacking someone else. And you can control how a challenge between two other players is going to go to manipulate your board state, as well as use it as a tool to protect yourself and so on.
Yeah, so not only is it killing characters, it's got this added value of being able to control challenges, which is so important, really, because people usually tend to try to... I mean, like you said, we haven't played a lot of 2.0 melee, but they usually tend to try to burst win, where they come out super strong and gain a lot of power really quick in one turn. So if you're able to control even one challenge from them, that can change the dynamic of a melee game significantly, very quickly.
And I think that you have to look for cards like that that have an effect that isn't necessarily against the opponent you won against. What's a good example? Shireen Baratheon. If she dies, you get to choose a character on the board and kneel it. It doesn't have to be against the player that initiated the challenge that killed her or that used the Valor or so on.
Right. And that's even a bargaining chip, right? Attack me, I'll kneel this other guy's character.
Exactly, exactly.
But since we were talking about Burst, that's one of the big things that I find is the difference between Joust and Melee, which is the fact that you want to be able to seem not very, you know, important, you're not going to really win the game, and then all of a sudden win. Well, in Joust, you don't care about that kind of thing because your opponent is trying to win versus only you and hold only you down, while in Melee, you're trying to seem inconspicuous so that they focus their efforts against someone else and then burst for the win. And that's a very different play style from Joust.
And the cards that I would say are examples of this, that the one that embodies it the most would be Doran's Game, or Superior Claim.
Or the Red Viper.
Or, well, the Red Viper can look
to a lesser extent
once he hits the board, but these hidden effects will generally can make the huge difference. So you pull a Doran's Game and get 4 or 5 power, that's changing the board. You play a Superior Claim on a Claim 2 power challenge, and you've just made a 4 to 5 power swing, not counting any renown. That's the kind of thing you need to do to go from not looking threatening to winning the game.
Yes.
There are other components that I tend to value more highly in Melee. One is initiative.
Absolutely. Melee games, a lot of time come down to whoever is going to go first is going to win this Melee game.
Well, there's that, and there's also that on the early rounds where no one's within threat of winning, controlling where you are in the title selection process and controlling where you are in seeing how opponents have declared challenges before you do is extremely important.
Because you'll get a lot more unopposed if you go last in the first round because people kneel out their characters.
Exactly right. And you have a lot more control. You don't have to save a whole bunch of characters to prevent certain very dangerous things from happening to you. You can use all the characters you have remaining. So I would go so far as to say that right now I think Sneak Attack is a compulsory one of in a melee deck. I think you want a turn where you can have 11 initiative and the Claim 2 can help too for a power challenge or a claim.
Yep. I agree.
I think there will be enough times where you need to control that initiative either to close the game or to get the opening you need that it's basically compulsory.
Yep.
What else? I mean, a lot of effects, you think of them differently. You know, March to the Wall affecting everybody, while Heads on Spikes only affects one player.
Heads on Spikes, less useful, yeah.
Except that it gives you power in a bursty way, so there's a lot of difference in the valuation.
You have to rely on luck, that's tough.
Yeah, that is tough. But one thing that I do think are more valuable in Melee are non-kneelers or characters that stand.
Yes.
Mostly because if they don't kneel on defense, then there's less of an incentive for people to attack you, and then you could still use the character. So I think that even more so than in Joust, because those non-kneelers can affect the position for 3 other players, they're more valuable.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, being able to have a wall in Melee that people think to themselves, oh, it's not really worth attacking that guy. I can get an opposed over here, or he'll have to kneel out his only character, is a big difference. So just having those non-kneelers really incenses desensitizes people from attacking you.
Disincentivizes.
There we go.
That's the word.
Thank you, Alex.
I think that's pretty much what I had. I'm not entirely sure. There was one thing I had written, and that was how to value deterrence. Things that, like Warm Rain, that punish someone for doing something against you.
They're worth more.
I think the deterrence that you can show on the board are more useful.
Yeah.
I'm not sure the hidden ones are worth more. They're still fine. They're still great cards.
If you have, Daenerys plus a Palace of Punishment or something, people won't attack you with their little characters because they don't want to be the one that gets their little character killed.
That gets eaten by that in the power challenge. Yeah, I think that's visible deterrents are more valuable. Hidden ones might be a little less valuable. They might be equally valuable. All right, the before last little mini segment that I wanted to run through was also inspired by watching the stream last week, or in the last week. It was someone asking if we could do some of the rules questions that I think people might be playing wrong. Some of the base little assumptions that either you're carrying over from first edition or you're a player who has no experience with Thrones and might be missing.
Does that mean we're going to play an Ask Dark Notch segment?
I could see probably I do this right. In the form of an Ask Dark Notch segment.
All right, let's do it.
All right, well, we'll start with probably the number one thing that first edition players are having trouble adapting to, and that brand new second edition players probably haven't sort of let sink in yet, the importance of it. The order of challenge resolution. Do you know this one?
Probably not. Let's go.
Okay, well, so that when resolving a challenge, what are the steps to resolving the challenge? Once you've attacked and you've declared stealth and they've defended, and then you go on to that strength comparison, what happens?
Winner determined responses. That's it.
I did the acronym on this cast, John. You don't listen to your own cast.
No, I have. It's like duck, determine winner. No, luck.
So I said luck, but Nate has changed it to duck at
okay, so see, it is luck.
So you are listening. All right.
It's
so,
duck.
So what is duck or luck for?
Determine winner, unopposed. CK.
CK, claim and then keywords.
There we go. See, I had it.
I've heard, yeah, I was initially pitching luck as determine the loser or figure out who loses or who wins, and then unopposed claim keywords. Nate was then using that as determine winner, so duck. I've heard figure out winners, which obviously we won't say on the cast. This is very, 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 very important. We don't currently have any reactions to the unopposed bonus or the rivals bonus. So that U step doesn't matter quite as much yet, although it could easily matter in the future.
Yeah.
But the reactions to winning unopposed or losing unopposed are in the winning and losing step.
And keywords is super important, which is something I do automatically, so I didn't really think of.
Yeah, so the keywords happening after means, for instance, insight draw will not draw you into a card like
that you can use to kill someone.
That's right. So it certainly changes that. I think the most important, though, is that the reactions to winning and losing are before claim.
Which is huge, because it actually means that something like War Reign, you can use before they take it out of your hand.
Yeah, that's a huge part of it. But it also means that you can, if you, say, trigger like War Reign, and you kill your opponent's Cersei that was modifying claim,
then the claim
no
would
more
still
bunch.
Be one
She's
instead
gone.
Of two.
The claim will still be one instead of two, exactly.
Yep, it's big.
And a small thing that people might be getting a little bit wrong is if you use a reaction to kill their defending character, the challenge doesn't become unopposed at that point. It was right. Determined to be unopposed or not when you compared strength and you proceeded through this. So using a throwing axe because your opponent blocked and killing their defender does not magically make the challenge have been unopposed the whole time.
Right.
All right, so question number two. You're nearing that taxation phase, and you have two more cards than your reserve value, and your opponent has two more cards than his reserve value. Who has to discard first?
Does it matter?
It certainly could matter.
First player.
First player does, in fact, have to discard first. I was thinking you were going to say first player could decide who discards first, but no. If multiple players have to make a choice at the same time, so this isn't resolving some conflict, but it's just simultaneous. All players have to choose something. The first player has to make that choice first.
If it's a conflict, though, first player gets to decide the order.
That's right. If it's all characters getting plus one strength and minus one strength or something like that, then the first player decides the order which they're applied. Although in those cases, it wouldn't really make a difference unless...
Well, it wouldn't matter if one of your characters was getting minus four and would die, and the other one was giving plus one, then they could kill the character before the plus one came into effect to save them.
One thing that this does matter, so I mentioned reserve. Another situation where this often comes up is in the plot phase for things like March to the Wall.
But honestly, right now, like reserve, that wouldn't really be affecting anything yet.
Well, if you see that your opponent, you could decide what you're ditching based on what your opponent's ditching. Right,
I guess,
if you see him ditch a bunch of characters, you can say, yeah, he's probably not going to Valor and refill the board because he's ditching his cheap characters. Okay, obviously he's not going to Valor at this point. But, that kind of information can be very useful. And unfortunately, as the first player, you're a little bit hampered there.
Right. Okay, sure.
And the same thing for Wildfire. First player then has to decide which three characters are surviving the wildfire before the opponent does, which means that if you pick three...
He doesn't have to worry about certain things. He can say, oh, he discarded all his guys with intrigue icons. I'm going to keep one of mine intrigue so that I can push through that unopposed later.
Exactly, yeah, that kind of thing. So that's one of the... It's almost one of the drawbacks to being the first player, but it's compensated by the fact that the first player got a big boost as well. And this is, I won't do it in the form of a quiz, but I'm going to quiz you on some examples on where it could really matter. The first player always gets first reaction, or first action in any phase. In first edition, if it was a framework action or a player action, it depended. So it was kind of confusing. Now, first player reacts first. So something happens, and you ask the first player, you know, do you have a cancel? Or you ask the first player, you know, any
reaction. Do you have a reaction? Do you have a save? Do you have whatever?
Yeah. And they get that first opportunity to act or pass. And this actually also makes a huge difference in challenge resolution, I find. So are there any cards that you can think of where this makes a big difference?
Well, I mean, you could kill a character that would have a reaction to losing a challenge.
Exactly. I don't know if we have any big characters. We have characters that react to dying and things, but not necessarily to losing a challenge. But the one I'm thinking of is Gaston Grey.
Yep.
Gaston Grey reacts to losing a challenge, and if Martell likes to go second...
Destroy the location.
Exactly. You could put to the torch, and Gaston Grey is gone before it can trigger, because there's no Moribund either, so it's just gone. So that's a case where being first player can make a huge difference if you get that reaction first. What else did I have? So this is most of these are going to be hard to form in the phrase of a question. Good Lord, because
you're as bad as I am now.
A lot of them are. I know. It's just we might as well throw in the towel.
Yeah.
Or should I say something that isn't a towel, a trowel, or something, just to make it? No. These are things that are kind of leading. Basically, keywords are optional. So I don't know if you can think of some of the implications of that.
Oh, it's huge. I mean, we're talking forget to stealth someone. You can forget to claim renown. You know, this was something that I always thought was wrong with 1.0, and I'm so happy to see it in 2.0, because I never liked the fact that I had to remind my opponent to claim all their keyword stuff, like to stand their characters for vengeful, or to gain their power, or stand their characters for vigilant. And I love the fact now that it's on them to remember, because it actually increases the player skill required for the game, in my opinion.
It does, and I can think of situations... I can't think of any in the core where you might be better off not claiming renown, or you might be better off not drawing for insight. Actually, I can think of those in the core.
If you don't want to draw for insight yourself. If that's your last, last card. You don't want to lose the game.
So there are situations in which that's also an advantage because it gives you that determination of skill. Yep. There's another one which is something that I think first edition players will definitely get wrong. New players probably won't realize that it even is a situation. And this is that in second edition, challenges don't immediately end if there are no more participants left.
Right, which it did, of course, in 1.0.
Yeah, so an example of a situation where this kind of thing can happen, for instance, is if you were to initiate a challenge with only one character, and then your opponent used Gaston Grey after losing, do you still go on to unopposed and claim? And the answer is yes. Or if, for instance, if your opponent attacks you and you used Dracarys to kill the only character, you still have the option of putting in a defender to win the challenge.
Right.
That's not that different from second edition. Well, in first edition, you could let them attack, block, and then nuke their character. And you
right,
still
but if you
one.
Did it wrong, you yeah. were screwed. And now, if there's like a... Say there's a new card that comes out that says, every time you win a challenge, claim two power. Now, you can kill their character, block, even though there's no characters in the challenge, win that challenge and get the two power.
Yeah, I think the place where this might be the most likely to change down the road is if you get characters that can jump into challenges. So you can start a challenge and then have that character lost and then still go, I don't want this challenge to end like this, 0-0.
Like so, the old naval.
Exactly, like a naval mechanic. You'll have more leeway to use it, which I think is, it's not necessarily inherently better or worse, but it's just
different.
It's different, exactly.
Yeah.
something else that I think is actually better is the absence of, for instance, pre-plot actions, but also pre-draw actions. There's no predominance action, no pre-taxation action. So you get to a phase, you do the thing the phase is about, and then you can take actions. And I think that pre-plot action window makes a pretty big difference.
It was a little confusing because you had the pre-plot, you know, the pre-whatever, then the action, then the after-action. It's better, just cleaner, just the after-action.
But I bet, I mean, if they release a card like Nightmares and things like that that you can use to blank cards, people
from First Edition
are going to try to use them before they flip their Valor and things like that. And you can't now. You know, not that way. If you want to, you know, make sure that you have a gold during your plot phase, you discard a card from your Old Forest Ranger during taxation in the taxation action window after you've lost all your gold. And then you can carry the gold over to the plot phase. You know, so there are ways to work around it. But, yeah, it certainly will change the way the plot phase especially plays out.
Yes.
I still have a few more. This one, again, shouldn't surprise any First Edition veterans, but in Second Edition, in all phases, players alternate actions. So the first player gets the first opportunity to do something, then the next player does. And the place where this is typically the most surprising to new players is the marshaling.
Right, because you might marshal something, and then your opponent might steal your gold, reducing your overall gold, before you can do anything else.
Well, the stealing the gold card is actually a reaction, so it would happen faster anyway. But the card that I'm thinking of is as the most important for that example, is the Lordsport Shipwright. It's the Greyjoy card that gets to kneel locations.
Yep.
So let's say your opponent plays down his King's Road. That was an action. He played a King's Road. So the next action is yours.
You kneel the reduction or whatever.
To kneel it, exactly, so that he can't use it to kneel. Yep. So it's important to note, not only are you still alternating actions, it's just that only one of the players can spend gold to marshal cards, but also, you know, the first player counts gold, does all his actions, and when he passes, his marshaling special actions basically go on to the next player, and that next player counts gold. So an effect like Meager Contribution that reacts to your opponent counting gold doesn't just start at the beginning of marshaling where everybody takes their gold, which you often see in streams and things like that where they're already counting up their gold. You got to remember that you only get your gold once
on your
turn. Exactly. Your turn to be the active player. And finally, the last ones that I wanted to go into are two strictly melee questions. Again, from having seen the stream.
That's good. I love melee. I do.
So melee has changed a little bit from First Edition. For instance, there's no more blocking for another player that you supported.
Depressing. That's too bad.
I think it's quite good. I think that slowed down games a lot.
No.
To keep track of all that. But
you thought that slowed down games? Really?
I think that slowed down games. Also,
that never slowed down one of my games, ever.
The number of people that believed, for no reason I can determine, that if you do that, you get a power from someone. Or for free from your
title. Oh, yeah. That was weird.
That was weird. I mean, it comes from the Lord Commander of the Kingsguard title where it specifically gave you that power. But for some reason, everybody else seemed to believe that if you blocked a challenge for someone else, you got this bonus power, which is definitely not the case. But here, that's no longer the case. Supports just means you can't attack that person. Rivals means if you attack them, you can get a power, even if
I still like the blocking.
You still like the blocking.
Just for the record.
So the first one that I want to talk about as being a little weird as a title is the Master of Whispers. I think this will be a very popular title, not because it's particularly powerful, but because it's a great negotiating tool. All right, so this title is the one that says, you may resolve your intrigue claim against any number of opponents of your choice. So what is so special about this?
Nothing, really, other than people think it's gross. Because you can negotiate with someone else to let your entry claim through so that you can hit someone else's hand.
Yeah, I think that's the main advantage, is that the any number of opponents means that you don't necessarily have to do it at all against the player against whom you win the challenge. So I can certainly see this being an easy tool to say, look, let me get that claim to intrigue against you. I won't even take the claim off against you.
Off you, yeah.
Against those other players.
Everyone else.
And if that gives you an extra unopposed bonus, that's a pretty good title.
Yeah.
Especially if you can do that against someone you rival, so you just got two power off the title. I mean, that's fantastic. And the opponent doesn't have much incentive to block. and the other players can't do much about it. So I think that it has some meat to it. The second title that I think is going to be quite interesting with a change in the rules now is the Crown Regent, which works very similar to the way it did in first edition. It allows you to redirect a challenge. The biggest difference here is that the redirect changes its targeting restrictions. So in first edition, you could only use it if there was someone else the challenge could be redirected against legally. So if they supported one person and they attacked you when it was a three-player game, you couldn't use the redirect because they can't attack the other person.
Correct.
But in second edition, the
support
bypasses it. Essentially, you're not initiating the challenge again, and all those restrictions are on initiating the challenge. So you initiated the challenge against the Crown Regent, but the redirect allows you to resolve the challenge against somebody else, if that makes sense.
Yes.
Which means that you can bypass all of these restrictions and say you can't attack that player because you support them or because of some card effect or that kind of thing. So I think that's a really neat thing. I think it's going to make a huge difference in three-player games especially, in making this title more valuable and
making the games more three-player games is going to have a huge effect.
Yeah. And in four-player games, I think it has a huge effect too because it allows you – you could even say like, look, we really want to –
It has an effect, just a smaller one.
Yeah, but there's a lot of situations where like, you know, he's playing next. I can't attack him and he's going to win. And then the board can sort of work together and say, look, attack me. I'll redirect this challenge so you'll get it against him. And it allows you to work as a table to overcome a support, which I think is kind of neat.
Yes, I agree with that. I like that. I actually think that Melee in 2.0, from what I've seen, because I haven't played a game, is a little bit more interesting than 1.0. And I liked Melee in 1.0. So.
Yeah, I like the new title selection and the way the titles work. I also... And this, you may disagree with me. I like that the deal-making tools aren't explicit deal-making tools like Summoning Season. I prefer the fact that people are playing...
I didn't like Summoning Season, so I agree with you. Absolutely.
Okay, yeah, see, I didn't really like that idea because...
Everyone always had to open it. Yeah.
But yeah, you basically all... sort of had to play by this convention of offering
and trade
something
in a circle. In yeah, it's no fun.
And those were also basically cards that you would only ever play in Melee, right? You know, because of the way they were giving an advantage. So now Summons still lets you go look for a character in Melee, which is still very advantageous, building up your board position. And a lot of other plots work more similarly. There's still deal making to be done. It's just at the level of play more than it is at the level of construction. And I think that's interesting.
Yes.
And that's all I got. Those are rules that you might have been playing wrong. It was going to be 10 rules that you might be playing wrong, but I don't think there were 10 in that list. So.
So, Alex, I heard a rumor. And this rumor is that you've been paying particular attention to the Ladies of Westeros in the current AGOT 2.0 core set. Is this true?
What can I say? I like me some... I don't even know if I can say that in some way that doesn't... No.
Say you like ladies. It's okay. There's nothing wrong with that. I could say I like men. You could say you like ladies. And there's nothing wrong with either of those. But personally, I like ladies.
I like lords. I like... Anyway. But no, as part of some of the short little segments that we wanted to join today, I was looking at some of the cards that do some things that are slightly unexpected or that rules questions come up about, and I was three or four cards in and realized
they were all
they
ladies.
Were all ladies. So I figured we could do a little segment, Ladies of Westeros. I don't know. They're not all of Westeros. Well, I guess maybe.
So what does Catelyn Stark do that's so special?
First of all, I've never heard of a Catelyn Stark, but Catelyn Stark is on my list, actually. She comes up a lot for rules questions, and one of the things that people don't necessarily realize is that she does not affect forced reactions, because forced reactions are initiated by the game. So Catelyn says she affects your opponent cannot trigger card effects. So if you win an unopposed challenge with her, people are wondering, hey, does the wall kneel? Does your opponent's wall? Or if you if she's involved in the challenge and they win it with Jorah, does he trigger his response, his forced reaction for getting a power? Does he sort of bypass that? And no, all those forced reactions still do happen. And since forced reactions are generally bad things, the fact that Caitlyn doesn't prevent them is actually something that makes her stronger than you'd otherwise expect.
And what about some of the other ladies, like Marjorie?
Marjorie, I didn't actually have anything too terribly surprising.
Are you saying that the sexiest woman of Westeros is not that important in your little
snippet here? She's a great character, but rules questions for her just haven't come up.
That depresses me.
She's just a very smooth-running card. There doesn't seem to be any major issues there.
All right, she's smooth, just like in real life.
There we go, she's smooth.
For the actress, that is.
One of the big ones that comes up a lot is, and this is sort of there are a couple of variations on it. Well, yeah, okay. Well, I guess we can start there.
I hear a ton of questions in my local meta about her because they're always like, well, can I kneel her for Daenerys Targaryen? And if I do, do they still get the minus one? And, well, no, they don't.
That's right. So you're not going to kill a five-cost character if you choose to pay the cost. The cost happens before the effect in the timing chart. But Danny, actually, there's another question that comes up, and I quite enjoy this one, because when I was first looking through the book with Helmet, to the rules reference guide here on the cast, one of the things he mentioned was, you know, why is there this entry defining against? Isn't that a little pedantic? And one of the first questions on Card Game DB when the rules came out, before the rules came out, was, what does against on Dany mean? Does it work both ways? Is it just if someone's attacking you, so they're against you?
Mm-hmm.
And so that entry in the rules reference guide really does matter. Against means it works both ways. If they're attacking you, their characters are in a challenge against you. If you're attacking them and they defend, their characters are in a challenge against you. Which makes Dany stronger.
Yeah. Again, the ladies get stronger.
The ladies get stronger. So the other one that I wanted to make sure we get out of the way, it's sort of the same ruling issue for sort of Melisandre and Queen of Thorns indirectly. The one for Melisandre that most often – two questions come up. The first is, does she trigger off herself entering play? And
one point of
veterans are quite comfortable with that. Yes, she definitely does. But people coming to the game from elsewhere aren't quite sure because the reaction wasn't in play when you played her, obviously, by definition. But that doesn't matter. The reaction just has to be present at the time for reactions to things entering play. And therefore, it's absolutely fine then. So she does trigger off herself. But from that same sort of ruling, you can talk about the Queen of Thorns. If you win with the Queen of Thorns, you could drop in a Tyrell character. If you don't have any in your hand, but you can play Olenna's Cunning or something like that,
and you
get to search for a character, even though that character wasn't in play, well, you triggered that response first to winning the Intrigue Challenge, and then you trigger the Queen of Thorns' reaction and put the character in play.
Yeah, so it doesn't matter. It's all about order. I mean, if you're stupid, you could choose to trigger the Queen of Thorns, put nothing into play, and then search Olenna's Cunning.
Technically, no, you can't trigger something that kind of doesn't have any possibility of changing.
Oh, that can't happen. Yeah, you're right. Okay, I'm sorry. Rules guy.
But this is important because in first edition, for instance, it was very frequently the case that you would win a challenge and then be able to draw off that challenge and then be able to play a card you drew off that challenge to then kill a character, like draw into a Tears of Lys. And you could still technically do that, but not if the draw is insight because keywords are later.
Right.
So this, again, it's all part of the sort of the same story. It's the idea that all of these reactions can happen provided you're still at the step for those reactions. But if you've moved on to keywords, which are the last step of that challenge resolution framework,
it's too late at that point.
It's too late to have drawn a Tears of Lys and then decide to play it. So as long as you're still within the right reaction window, you can keep playing to that reaction. But Melisandre has a second thing, because now that we know she triggers off herself, the question that comes up is, does she trigger off a dupe of herself?
No.
That's right. She doesn't. When a dupe enters play, it wasn't a R'hllor card anymore. It's just a blank card. So since one didn't successfully come into play, you can't trigger the reaction. More ladies. I got stuff from more ladies. What other ladies?
Brienne of Tarth.
There isn't a
Brienne of Tarth. Not interesting.
There isn't a Brienne of Tarth in second edition.
Right. I'm sorry. There isn't. Yes, of course there's not.
Arianne Martell.
Everything blurs, Alex.
I know. Ariane Martel is another one that I thought had a neat little effect that I mentioned actually in one of the reviews of this card on CardGameDB. Turns out that you can use her to bring in herself if you have another copy in your hand. And because if you do that, you didn't successfully bring a character into play, the second effect, the then effect that would bounce her, doesn't trigger. So basically, if you wanted to, it's limit once per phase. If you didn't have any other characters, or you just drew into that Ariane dupe in the middle of combat because of Doran's insight or something like that, you could then trigger Ariane to just dupe her for free in the challenges phase, which is a neat little trick. It's not often the best use of her, but sometimes it's the easiest way to get claim soak.
Yes. It's pretty a specialized circumstance.
Okay, let's see if you can guess the little tidbit that I wanted to give about the final lady I had on my list, Sansa Stark. Is there anything that strikes you as a little odd about that card that people might want to know?
Well, let's read out the card, you know, just to refresh people.
He's buying Alex. Time. He's buying time.
Actually, I have no idea what the card does.
Sansa Stark is a stats and lady and all that other stuff, but it's obviously her effect that I care about. It says, Sansa Stark enters play knelt. Reaction after Sansa Stark stands, gain one power for your faction, limit once per round. Now again, this is something that a first edition player would be entirely comfortable with. But
okay, this is the issue then. I'm probably entirely comfortable with it, so I'm not seeing any obvious issue.
Okay, well, the issue that has come up a couple of times is, if you set up Sansa Stark, does she start the game knelt?
No.
Correct. It's placing cards, revealing cards. Cards do not enter play. They do not react to coming into play. You can't do any of that other stuff. So Sansa Stark, if she is set up, she was placed and then revealed.
Yep.
She's standing up for that first turn. So
I can definitely see who, for people that haven't played the game before, how that would be confusing now that you pointed it out.
So I think that's five little tidbits.
Five little ladies?
About five little ladies. That's condescending. Five fantastic ladies. Some of
How is it condescending?
To call them little ladies? They're not little ladies.
Well, maybe. I mean, some of them could be. Danny's pretty short.
I thought you were convinced Danny was a man.
And I named my daughter after her?
Well, you know, you didn't see the box art for 2.0 at that time.
That's true. She's a man.
All right, closing comments, John. Do you have anything for us to wrap up the show?
FFG, get me more core sets. And the first chapter pack, please.
And the first chapter pack.
Yeah, I'm greedy. I want everything.
I suspect we'll see an announcement for the fourth chapter pack in...
That doesn't help me.
Not next
week. They can announce the 10th chapter pack, the 50th chapter pack. I want one chapter pack in stores.
I do have one tournament announcement that is worth noting. On the 19th and 20th in Sweden, we have Varberg Morgulis this week. So that's this coming weekend. This is a first edition tournament. It's now officially part of the Road to Stalag this year for the first time. And
the Swedish guys are awesome, so go down.
Swedish guys are awesome. We were pegging them as the best meta in the world until the Dutch started winning all these things. So
Dutch. So
we'll see who claims their title. I really like their
good on the Dutch though.
Last year, the alt art cards for Varberg Morgulis, we got some at Worlds. There's the sort of cartoony little like the lions.
Yeah, they're very fun. Actually,
they're a lot of fun, and the colors are really nice on them.
They're my favorite all art cards, even above ours. I mean, I'm happy to play with those still.
I mostly like alternate art house cards and things rather than play cards, because it doesn't confuse your opponent as much if they're not used to them and so on.
Yep.
You know, we're used to card recognition, but for house cards, you can do almost anything you want. So I use alternate art house cards. I don't tend to use alternate art cards in my deck. So.
Me too.
I do like that variation.
Thank you for listening to Beyond the Wall. If you have any comments or would like to be featured on the cast, please let us know by email at beyondthewallpodcast@gmail.com or through Facebook at Beyond the Wall Podcast. If you've enjoyed the music, check out more of Antti Martikainen's work at the link embedded in the chapter data. See you all next week.